I'm only going to buy songs I wish I wrote or projects I wish I work on. And I'm going to pass on everything else. Because if I can't tell you straight up, I want to live and breathe this, we shouldn't be doing it.
That's hit songwriter and independent music publisher Evan Bogart. Welcome to Musonomics. I'm Larry Miller from the Music Business Program at NYU Steinhardt. Music publishers manage and often own or co-own the rights to license and collect money for the use of songs, when making recordings of the songs, for streaming, radio and TV broadcasting, synchronizing that music in movies and TV shows for opening and closing titles and background uses, and much more. And it's not small. Music publishing is a little over a $10 billion worldwide business that grew 12% last year, according to Mydia Research. And Mydia is forecasting over 65% growth to almost $17 billion in 2031. Music publishing is complicated, detailed, and creative, and it's the least well-understood sector of the music industry. Over the last decade, revenues grew a lot as streaming took hold and royalty rates improved. But in the earliest days of streaming, publishing was on the back foot as record labels and streaming services set the agenda. But with successful lobbying here in the U.S. and around the world, rates and collections have improved. We recently unpacked the dispute between publishers and Spotify about how that company pays publishers and songwriters in the U.S. Publishers have responded with confidence and force. We've written a lot about this, especially on how streaming impacted the value of music. You can get that free report at musonomics.com. The twin trends of increased opportunity and investor interest cry out for new thinking and new business models in music publishing. In this episode, we'll talk to Tatiana Sirisano, who documents that transformation at Mydia Research, and two young, successful, independent music publishers, Evan Bogart from Seeker Music and Lillette Pizarro from Influence Media. First, Tatiana Sirisano, who, along with NYU Music Business recent alum Fernanda Balzaretti, co-authored Mydia Research's new report, Songwriters Take the Stage, A New Playbook for a New Era. With so much focus on recording artists and record labels and streaming platforms, why, Tati, the focus on songwriters now?
Yeah, well, it's kind of inherent in your question almost that I think the songwriting and often publishing side of the industry is not as represented in music industry dialogue a lot of the time. And even at Mydia, our main focus of research is the recorded music market. So we've done so many studies and so many surveys on that side, including an annual music creator survey, which is open to all creators, including songwriters, but ends up being much more focused on the performing artist side and the recording artist side. So I think we really wanted to give songwriters the attention they deserve and also recognize these days, most songwriters are also performers in some respect, but their needs and their focuses on those two sides of their business are totally different and require different nuanced sets of services, right? So we wanted to make sure we're giving each side its own attention. So we did something we've never done before, which was our first songwriter survey at Mydia, which is super exciting.
So what songwriters are we talking about?
Yep. So whenever we do creator surveys, it usually ends up being a sample that is skewed a little bit towards earlier stage creators and ones that aren't as professional, simply because if you aren't a professional, you usually have more time to take surveys. You're usually the people that sort of self-select for these types of things. So the overall sample is a bit skewed in that direction, but we created segments for songwriters by income level, by level of experience and things like that, so that we could see what is the difference between how an earlier stage songwriter and a professional with a full-time income are answering all these questions. And it was mainly US and UK, even though it was open globally.
So let's talk about how writers view their role and what success looks like to them. How do songwriters define success?
Yeah, that's a great question. Let me look at, I have our, it's like a 50-page survey, and I have it open because I wanted to be able to check since there's so much in here. So when we look at success, the top thing beyond being creatively fulfilled, which is, of course, that's why a lot of creators get into this, is earning a sustainable living from their craft. And that directly correlates with when we asked them about their challenges. The majority said that the lack of meaningful income from streaming is their top challenge. So you see this very clear message there where songwriters today aren't able to diversify their revenue in the same way that artists are through things like merchandise and touring. And with songwriters, you're still heavily reliant on royalties. So just like artists, when we do these types of surveys, songwriters are looking for a sustainable income and to be creatively fulfilled, yet they have very different and in some cases stronger challenges in that regard.
And how is the way songwriters get income from the sale or consumption of music shifted over the last 10 years? It's pretty significant, and you should probably comment on that.
Yeah, absolutely. Really important to put it into context. So in the CD era, songwriters used to earn the majority of their income up front, right, by the CD on sale. And that was followed by a really steep drop in earnings because you weren't monetizing consumption past the point of initial sale. And it also didn't matter if you were a songwriter and your contribution to the album was a flop, because as long as the album was selling, you were making money, right? But now there's sort of this double-edged sword to streaming, as it's been for, I think, everyone in the music industry, where now songwriters are monetizing every listen, and there's more places to license and monetize music than ever, but royalties are earned incrementally over time. So even though the lifetime revenue from a song is much higher than it was in your CD era, it's a lot harder to make a living day-to-day as a songwriter because you're earning these royalties so slowly and sort of like this trickle over time.
And many more co-writes too, like many more.
And many more co-writes, correct.
We have a number of negative drivers on the one hand, sort of driving down the amount of income per unit of consumption or per stream, really weighing down, especially early career stage songwriters. What are some of the positive drivers?
Yeah, great question. I mean, there are, like I said, way more places to play music and to license music than ever before. But I think within that, there's also culture has been, I think, elevating the composition in recent years because of the whole sort of remix culture that we're in, where today's fans don't just want to listen to the music that they love. They want to play around with it. They want to post their own dance to it. They want to be involved in some way. And a lot of times that's been through things like interpolations and remixes and covers. So there's this, the cultural capital, I think, of the composition has been growing. But there is this need to sort of match the cultural weight with financial weight to that. But I think that's still a really important driver. And then also things like improved data and transparency, even though metadata, as anyone involved in this knows, is still a huge issue for songwriters and others in the industry. These things are improving. Deal terms for songwriters are improving. So there's a lot of positives on the other end of the, you know, inhibitor side.
We've talked a lot about music publishers and the relationship between publishers and writers. Can music publishers fill the gap in expectations between what services are available to especially early career stage songwriters now and what that might evolve toward in the future?
Yeah, so it was really interesting, the questions that we asked about publishers, because you know, one of the things that we heard from a lot of the songwriters that we interviewed for this survey is that when you sign with a publisher, oftentimes it's hard to get personalized care because these publishers have massive catalogs and they're really only able to focus on sort of the top earners. So then when we flip that into the survey and we asked songwriters who were signed to publishing deals, whether it was a co-publishing or a straight up publishing deal, why they chose to sign that deal, the overwhelming answer was just to have this reassurance that their royalties would be collected, which is, of course, the most important job that a publisher can do, but not the only one, right? There's so many other things that publishers are there for, like helping plug your songs, helping connect you to other songwriters, pitching you for sync, things like that. But what we found from the survey is that there's this sort of, something's getting lost in translation along the way, where for the songwriters, they're not understanding that added value that publishers are giving them as much as maybe they should. So that was actually one of our recommendations from the survey, is that publishers better communicate their added value, especially as songwriters are trying to diversify their revenue beyond just back-end royalties from streaming. So trying to kind of match that from the publisher's perspective.
What about songwriter managers? You wrote a bit about that. So who gets a manager and who doesn't?
Yeah, that's a good question. We found that most songwriters, I believe, didn't have a manager but wanted one. So yes, 52% of the songwriters in our sample said they don't have a manager but would like to. And we found that they're seeking out managers for those types of added value services, like someone to help connect you to collaborators, help pitch your songs. Think pitching wouldn't really come in there because that's usually the publisher's job, but just helping songwriters with these sorts of things definitely seems to be an untapped market. And we also found that for songwriters, many are trying to build a brand and image around their songwriting, which was one of the more surprising elements to me, because you think of songwriters as often becoming a songwriter because they like to be a little bit more behind the curtain and creating music and creating hits without necessarily needing the spotlight. But I think we're seeing, because of that need to diversify revenue and because, you know, the music and the social worlds are just sort of combining, we saw that actually the majority of songwriters across age groups are using social media to build a brand and an image around their songwriting. And so that was another thing that we found songwriters are looking to managers for help with, is building a bigger brand and an image, both within the industry and outside of it.
Did you see any great examples that really stuck out for how to build a brand for a songwriter using social media? Yeah. Like, who's doing this really well?
Yeah, one of the songwriters we watched a lot of her content for was Bonnie McKee, actually, a songwriter who I believe she's written for Katy Perry and a bunch of other big pop singers. And she's done a lot of videos where she'll talk about, oh, you know, this famous line in this hit song, it was almost this, and then we made the change last minute. Or she'll kind of tell other little tidbits and lore that pop music stands love to hear. And if you look at a songwriter like Bonnie, her followers across platforms are lower than for Katy Perry herself or whoever it is. But there's still this segment, I think, of music superfans who really want to dig behind and find all of the nuggets of information about their favorite songs and artists. And often that includes figuring out who is the songwriter. So this is one of the songwriters we looked at, but there were many others that are escaping my memory right now.
Do writers think publishers will grow in impact or value or not?
It's a good question from the songwriter side. We didn't speak about that specifically with a lot of songwriters, but we did hear from others in the publishing industry or music executives about how the role of a publisher does seem to be becoming more important to how songs are made, the relationships that artists have with their producers and their songwriters in the studio to crafting visions. In terms of the A&R process, I would say publishers are becoming more important to that process and could become even more important in the future.
And how about songwriter managers? What do you think?
I think there's an untapped market for it, but this was really the beginning of that. Looking at this in the survey, it was, I think, something we didn't necessarily expect to see in the result, that there was this much of a desire. But there are some publishing companies, like there's a sort of boutique company called Architect out of LA that has a publishing side and also a management side, and they're specifically catering to songwriters and publishers. So we're starting to see it, but it's, I think, too early in the research for me to know just how big that market is.
You and others at Midia have written a fair amount in recent years about the full stack music company.
Yeah.
Can you say what you mean by that?
Yeah, so we're starting to see more and more parts of the music value chain housed under the same roof, everything from creation to distribution, both the publishing and recorded side through to release and marketing and promotion. It's not just the majors having their own major publishing companies alongside the recording anymore. You see companies like Create Music Group, and like Cobalt, that have so many different sides to their business. So I think we're starting to see across the industry, every sector is sort of merging into backwards and forwards, trying to own, I guess, more parts of the value chain. And publishing is included in that.
And what implications or conclusions do you draw for music publishers specifically about the results of the survey that you published, or just really cool insights that you picked up along the way?
Yeah, I think really number one was the need to better communicate their added value for songwriters. And that question that I mentioned about songwriters just overwhelmingly choosing publishers as a way to collect their royalties when there's all these other things available. And we sort of liken this in the report to, you know, 5 or 10 years ago, there were companies coming about saying they were going to offer label services, and the record labels weren't really worried about that. But now, of course, there's this huge market for label service companies that are really becoming competitors to the labels. So this is sort of a way, I think, to get ahead of that competition is by better communicating that they do offer all of these other services to songwriters. I would say the other thing that was surprising had to do with sync, because we saw that sync just kept coming up in so many questions that we asked songwriters as sort of this almost like a silver bullet for success. Like songwriters kept seeing, you know, oh, how do you find success? Sync. What tools and services are you looking for? Sync services. It was always coming back to sync. And when we really looked at the numbers and tried to evaluate the market for it, we realized that, of course, there's a very limited number of opportunities out there for sync, right? Every artist is only ever going to get a certain, you know, number of syncs in their lifetime, and there's only a certain number available. And so when we compared the percentage of annual income from sync that full-time songwriters were making compared to what sync contributes to the overall publishing market, it was pretty similar. So our takeaway from that is a lot of these songwriters have actually already maxed out on what they will probably earn from sync in terms of like how it contributes to their overall revenue. So one of our recommendations actually was for publishers and other partners on the publishing side to better educate songwriters about sync and make it clear that this isn't necessarily the one thing that's going to solve all of your problems and the one income source to really depend on. It's obviously something to strive for and something that's very important, but that maybe more attention could be put into diversifying revenue streams and growing other revenue streams beyond sync. So that was a really interesting one as well.
Why do you think so many writers view sync as a kind of a magic bullet and a thing that they kind of focus on?
Well, it sort of accomplishes so many different things at once. It gives you a front end check. It gives you a boost in your back end revenue because you usually see like a boost in streams of that song. It gives you more recognition. It, you know, ties you to a popular TV show or game or wherever that sync is happening or advertisement. So I think they see it as a solution to a lot of issues. It boosts their back end royalties. It boosts their front end royalties. It gives them more cultural recognition. It helps them build their brand in the industry. It does serve a lot of purposes, so I guess I'm not surprised.
Evan Bogart is a songwriter, music publisher, artist, and scion of a musical family whose exploits stretch back over more than 50 years. Evan is founder and CEO of Seeker Music.
Evan, Seeker Music has been doing some rather noteworthy things lately. But before we get to that, I have some questions about you as a songwriter.
Sure.
Not everybody starts writing songs and gets number one hits right out of the gate. So can we rewind back to that time of your life and tell us like what was going on and how did that happen?
Yeah, I always liken that to like being like, oh, I want to play golf and like walking on a golf course and just hitting a hole in one. And being like, oh, wow, like, I guess I can play golf.
Right.
And then, of course, at that point, you're like, wait, how did I do that? And you have to figure out how to actually play golf, which was pretty much my story with respect to songwriting. But going, you know, getting ahead of myself, I kind of came out of this period in my life where I had this really early success as like a young A&R, mailroom to A&R story in the 90s, like the old, you know, like started in the mailroom and like, you know, got promoted thing, and which I highly recommend to anybody getting into the business. Start at the bottom and work your way up. It's super worth it, although at the time it's really hard and painful. But looking back, it was super informative and I learned a lot about myself and a lot about how to work with people and at a company and be collaborative and all sorts of life lessons. But after working at Interscope Records for the second half of the 90s in my early teenage, young adult life, I found myself as a manager and an A&R consultant and having some pretty decent success doing that as well. And then, you know, like many lost souls in Los Angeles, got kind of caught up in like the hype of the nightlife and the party scene and threw it all away. And literally just threw it all away and ended up moving home with my parents in my early 20s and had somewhat of a moderate substance abuse problem and was broke and directionless and basically found myself begging myself into an assistant job at an agency. And luckily they hired me because they saved my life. And very long story short, about 5 months later, I got sober. And I've been sober ever since, so 19 years and change now. But in my sobriety, I found myself becoming really creative. And while I was an assistant at this agency called APA, I put together a girl group on the side. And all of my $400 a week was being funneled into studio time. And about 40 songs in of like people sending me songs for the girl group to cut, some friends of mine were like, why don't you try writing the songs? And I was like, pop songs? And they're like, yeah, you should try writing them. Like, you're so passionate about the group, you really understand them. And I wrote a song. They were like, you wrote that? And they're like, write another one. So I wrote another song. They're like, that sounds like a hit. Let's go get the group a deal. And after we basically shopped the group to every label and every label passed, the writing was on the wall. We ended up selling the songs because people wanted the songs, but they didn't want the group. And the second song I wrote for the girl group became a song called SOS for Rihanna. About 6 months later, I had my first cut, which was also my first number one, which was also Rihanna's first number one. And then I spent about 4 months trying to be an agent. I got actually promoted to being an agent the same day the song went number one. Very weird. Like maybe still the best day of my life other than my wedding and the birth of my two children. It was a crazy day. And the next 4 months I spent trying to be an agent and a songwriter full time. And I became mediocre really quickly at both. And so 4 months into that, this guy who was managing a producer friend of mine basically was like, what's it going to take for you to leave the agency? And I said, I don't know, get me in the studio with Britney Spears. And the next week, I spent a week with my buddy JR, who I did the Rihanna song with in Vegas, working on the Blackout album. And I came back and quit, went into songwriting full time.
The traditional struggle fest of becoming a successful songwriter isn't really part of this story, weirdly.
It's a different struggle, I think. I think the whole sobriety part of it was a struggle. The whole moving home after having this like really early, like successful trajectory and having this real blow to your ego in your early 20s and like having this kind of like quarter life crisis and having to pivot basically and start again, really from the bottom again as an assistant and try to work my way up in a different part of the industry and learn something completely new. And then getting sober and trying to maintain your sobriety and get back on your feet. And like, I there was my own struggle, right? You know, it wasn't the same as like, I sat there for a decade toiling and writing terrible songs. And, you know, I didn't even know I had it in me. I honestly was kind of like forced out of necessity to be a songwriter. And then I realized, you know, well look, in high school, I was an aspiring rap artist and DJ and producer that no one wanted to sign. So, but I didn't know I had writing hit pop songs in me, but I was a fan of creating and I found myself to be very creative. And I think sobriety was the spark that flamed that, you know?
Tell me a bit about how Halo happened.
Oh, so when I was at the agency, one of the first bands that I got to work with was a up-and-coming band that another assistant named Brett had gone to school with the lead singer in Oklahoma. And they actually had just moved to LA from Denver. They were a band called Republic. And the lead singer of that band, well, you would now know them as One Republic. And the lead singer of that band was a gentleman named Ryan Benjamin Tedder. And Ryan and I became fast friends working at the agency. And when I was putting together this girl group, he was one of the two people who were giving me songs to cut songs on the girl group. It was an unknown J.R. Rodham before he became a big producer and an unknown Ryan Tedder before he became a big superstar and producer. And Ryan and I would write songs after SOS came out. Like when I would leave the agency at night, I'd write with J.R., I'd write with Ryan. And after a couple years, Ryan and I, you know, became really, really good friends. And we wrote a lot of songs together. And one day, One Republic was on tour. They were on a college tour in the Midwest, and I think it was an off day in Michigan, outside of Detroit, and Ryan tore his Achilles playing basketball and had to cancel the rest of the tour and flew back to LA And the first day back, I went to keep him company and brought him some lunch and just to hang. And as soon as his wife left for work, he jumped up on his crutches and said, "Let's go write." And I was like, "Nah, you're supposed to rest." And he's like, no, let's go, let's go. So we went into his, he lived in a 2-bedroom apartment at the time. We went into his second bedroom, which was his studio. And we sat there and I said, "What should we write?" And he said, "You know, Jay Brown, who was Jay-Z's right hand, is Jay-Z's right hand, and a legendary executive in his own right, he basically said he's looking for a love song for Beyonce. And it's basically like the worst kept secret in the world at the time that Beyonce and Jay-Z were together. Everybody knew, but they hadn't come out." And we sat there having this discussion about like, what would two people who were larger than life and could only find comfort in each other want from each other? Like, what do you want in a relationship like that? This private relationship. And at the time, there was an artist named Ray LaMontagne who had put out this incredible album. At the time, he put out this for his first album, and he had a song on there called Trouble, but he had another song on there called Shelter. Both of them just chills. And we thought Shelter. We thought what Ray sings about in Shelter, this "you will shelter me and I will shelter you," like you're my safety and I'm your safety. Like, you know, no one else gets us, but as long as we have each other, we feel safe in each other's arms. And we were like, how do we surround each other like that? And so I was going down, I keep like a giant list of concepts and lyrics and phrases, melodies. You know, as a top line writer, I have always coming to sessions with these, like, you know, an arsenal of ideas. So in case we get stuck somewhere. And just as my finger landed on the word halo, Ryan hit this patch on his keyboard of these angelic sounds, which are in the song. And I was like, what about halo? And we looked at each other and we were like, yeah. And 3 hours later, we had the song written. Sent it immediately to Jay Brown. An hour later, he said, hold this for Beyonce. And the funny thing is, the next day, we didn't write a bridge. The next day, we decided to come back, and we were like, well, we should write the bridge. Now, we know that they love the song for Beyonce. So we spent 3 hours overthinking this bridge, because now we're like, you know, psyching ourselves out because Beyonce is cutting it, right? Only for her, when she recorded the song, to take the bridge out completely and do the opera part. So the part that took us the longest to write, she just ditched anyway, which is amazing. But you can actually find Ryan's demo. Somehow it leaked. It's online somewhere. And you can actually hear the original bridge that he's singing.
So the transition to publishing and starting Seeker, how did that happen?
Shortly thereafter, I love this. It's so linear. Shortly after, I find myself bouncing around a lot when I tell this story, and this way it's great because we're just going straight forward. Shortly after Halo and this run with Ryan and this run with JR, I started missing the A&R part that I had coveted so much when I was at Interscope and then as a manager and then as an agent and discovering bands. I missed the A&R and discovery part of my life. I was born with that gene, obviously, from my parents of artist discovery and development. And I decided in 2010, I wanted to start signing and developing writers and artists on the side while I was writing songs. So I signed two artists then. The first one was a woman named ZZ Ward, who many years later has now become my wife and the mother to my two children. So that really worked out better than I thought it would at the time. But she's had
very, very good signing.
Yeah, good signing. She's had a very decent career. She's played a million festivals and sold a bunch of records. And so she's had a great career. But I love our family, obviously. And the second one is I signed a kid named Ricky Reed, who went on to become probably one of the biggest producers of the last decade. You know, 3-time Grammy Producer of the Year nominee, discovered Lizzo and, you know, produced a billion hits for everybody. And I was off and running, kind of signing and developing artists and writers and producers at the same time as writing songs. Fast forward to like 2019, almost 10 years later, after having success doing both and wearing both hats, I just felt kind of bored, to be honest. I just felt like I had been doing the same thing for a decade plus, and I wanted to be more to more people. I felt like my brand of songwriter-led, music creator-led publishing and artist development could be done in scale. And so I decided either I was going to like try to raise some money, which I didn't really know how to do at the time, or I was going to go more likely into a bigger company and go inside for the first time since really Interscope, kind of APA, but really Interscope from a record side. And after talking to a bunch of majors and a few major indies, I just by happenstance got introduced to these investors from the UK who said, look, we've been doing diligence for the last year in the space, and we want to build the next great independent music company, and we're looking for someone creative to lead it. And I said, well, here's how I would do it. And I got up from the meeting and I thought, they're never going to call me. They don't understand a word I just said to them. And instead, they really loved, they said, you're the first person who doesn't sound like you're regurgitating a Music Business Worldwide article. You sound like you've actually been in the trenches. You've actually done this. And we'd love to keep talking to you. And I was like, sure, whatever. I'm going to go work for someone else, but like, sure, let's keep talking. And about 4 months later, we just really fell in love with each other, and they flew out to LA from London, and we sat in a room the day after Grammys 2020, and we basically spent 10 hours sketching out what Seeker Music would look like, and we shook hands and we went into business. And then of course none of us knew that a month and a half later we'd all be locked in our living rooms. But at the time, you know, we were going to build this company where sometimes we sign things and develop them, and sometimes we buy catalogs, which I had never done before. I was really excited to learn a new skill set in this business. And they were going to surround me with really smart people. And then the pandemic happened, and largely the creative part of the business, the part that I knew that I was bringing to the table, was really put on ice for like the better part of 2020, almost the entire year. A lot of songwriters I knew weren't even writing. They were taking stock of their lives. They were moving to Joshua Tree or to Miami. Like, people were like making big life decisions in 2020. And I guess I did too. I started a brand new company, but I was forced to focus only on the catalog side. And so I spent about 4 months being mentored by former CFOs of major publishing companies, and I got really good at it, like really quickly, and I really loved them. A really quick study, and I learned a lot about finance and the financial side of publishing. That's the stuff that as a creative I didn't really have exposure to. And 4 months in, and by July 1st I bought my first catalog, and by the end of July I bought a second catalog, and by the end of that year we had bought 10 catalogs, and I was running. We were off and running, and then we just kept growing, and I hired a CFO, and I started hired a COO, and we started putting together board, and you know, it was like, wow, this is like, be careful what you wish for, right? Like, we're building a real company here. All virtually, all Zoom. I mean, I remember my CFO and I worked together for almost an entire year before we met in person. She was in New York and I was in LA, and we were on Zoom, you know, but it was amazing. And yeah, you know, 3.5, almost 4 years later, you know, we're a company of 22, 23 people now, and headquarters in LA, and recording studios, enough people in New York that we could probably have a second office there, and people in Nashville and overseas in London and Copenhagen, and like, you know, full service publishing and record label, where still sometimes we buy things, sometimes we sign things, and we look at it all through the lens of what can we do creatively.
Many successful companies write down the things that they are good at, or one way or another, the values that drive the company. And we understand Seeker to be a creatively driven, like a really creatively driven music publishing company. But you, I think, knew a lot of these things as a writer as you went to start the company. What are those things that drive the culture at Seeker?
I wanted to build, first and foremost, a publishing company that I wish I could have been signed to at some point in my career. I saw a lot of good when I, you know, I was signed to a major publisher, I was signed to a major indie publisher, and have been signed to an admin company. So I've seen kind of all of it, right? And I've seen how writers are treated by not only the companies that they're signed to, but also by the industry. It's given me drive to be a staunch advocate for songwriters. It largely plays into all of the volunteer work that I do with the Recording Academy as the chair of the Songwriters and Composers Wing and the Board of Trustees for the Recording Academy. And, you know, all of the advocacy I do in DC and locally. And I think I wanted to build a home for songwriters that felt like we were putting songwriters first. Then, you know, things like I would never offer a deal I wouldn't sign myself, or I wanted to make sure that when we were acquiring things on the catalog side, I wanted to know what people's intentions were of why they were selling. Like, you know, red flags for me, like, well, my manager said it's a good idea. Like, no, like, that's not a reason you should sell, you know, like, and I've even talked people out of selling because of them having the wrong intentions, and me basically explaining to them, you know, unless you have a plan for this money, I don't think it's a great idea. Like, for me, I really care about the music creator community, and I wanted to put that first and foremost. So we don't just acquire rights. We acquire things that we first and foremost love. I mean, my agreement with my investors was that I'm only going to buy songs I wish I wrote or projects I wish I work on, and I'm going to pass on everything else, because if I can't tell you straight up, I want to live and breathe this, we shouldn't be doing it. And now that I have a team, you know, I put that to the team as well, right? Like, if my team isn't all about this and jumping up and down, and they come to me with a plan, we don't go after it. And that's the same approach I took as a songwriter signing other songwriters. And I've applied that to the principle and the practice of acquiring catalogs. So when we do, then we celebrate it. We celebrate the songs, we celebrate the songwriters, we love them, and it's our job to show the world why they should love them, or fall in love with them again, or rediscover them, or, you know, in this case of a newer generation on like a TikTok or something, discover them for the first time. There's so much discovery happening, and there's so much great music out there that just needs to have a light shine on it again. And so we take the same approach to shepherding songwriters, and we apply that to shepherding songs. And it makes our job deeply meaningful and fun. Honestly, it makes our job fun.
You've spoken a lot about songwriters and songwriting and branding and the power of no, the power of saying no.
Yeah.
How does that tie into this culture of championing and believing the thing that you are either signing or buying?
I think songwriters themselves are a brand, right? You have a brand. There's something that's inherently special and uniquely special about you as a songwriter and what you bring to the room when you write. I feel like a lot of times the booby trap that people get into in this business as an artist and as a songwriter is you say yes to everything because you don't know where the opportunity is going to come from. And, like, you know, I think intuitively that makes sense. Except for if you're saying yes to everything, then you're not training the industry or the universe to bring you the things that you truly love. You're saying yes to everything from a place of fear, from a place of desperation, from a place of FOMO. Like, you're not saying yes to everything because you love everything. It's impossible for you to love everything. There are things that jump out ahead of the other things that really raise their hand. And if you can just be in tune with those things and make sure that you just effing love it before you say yes to it. You imagine when it comes to the day that I'm working with this person or this artist or this producer, am I waking up that day and am I jumping out of bed like I cannot wait to get to the studio? And if you don't feel that, don't say yes. If you do say yes and you go to those things and you love it, the odds are you're gonna write something amazing and great. And that's been my experience, is that the things that I've been fully in love with, that I could just completely lose myself in the session, have been the times that greatness have come. And the times that I've went to go and write things where I've done it because I'm supposed to do it, other people are doing it, if I don't do it, what if I'm missing out on an opportunity? It's just never been great. It's always been like, we're supposed to write a hit. When you're supposed to write a hit, you never write a hit. And so I preach to my songwriters this power of no. No helps brand you as a writer. No helps teach people what to bring you. And in success, you start having the universe and the industry start bringing you things that you love only, and you do them with 100% of your heart because you love them. And then in turn, your success rate goes up. And I've seen it happen numerous times. So we create these blueprints. When we sign songwriters, we create these strategy decks and this approach to how to kind of level up and break into certain rooms that ideally will get you into the bigger rooms with the artists that you absolutely love the most. And there's this path that we walk people on. And it's very intentional. And it's not for everybody. Some people are like, huh, what? And I'm like, just trust us. Just trust us here. This is like we're guiding you, you know? And I apply the same thing to catalogs, right? We say no to probably 80, 90% of the catalogs that come to us because we don't love it. Even if we do love it, we don't have a strategy for it, that we're not the right company for it. We learn to say no and only say yes to the things that we think we can genuinely be in love with and successful with.
What should we look forward to from Seeker in the second half of this year?
Well, we're obviously continuing to sign and develop things and continuing to acquire things. That just gives us more toys to play with, you know, in the sandbox, right? And so we're doing a lot of amazing things. We're expanding into the Latin space. We've expanded more into our investments in Europe and in London and things there. We started a record label called Music Is Fun, which you can imagine would be the name of the record label that we would start. And we've had a couple artists that are starting to make noise. There's one Scottish band called Dead Pony that our head of creative, Stephen Melrose, discovered that's just taking the UK by storm. BBC is playing them. They're playing all these incredible festivals and tours, and like they're just really starting to take off. And another artist here in the US that we signed as a venture with Pete Wentz from Fall Out Boy called Carr, who's also really making a lot of noise. So we're starting to really come online with our label, which is great. It's exciting. We've also have a sample platform where basically have created this opportunity for creatives to get in the sandbox with us with respect to our catalog and sampling and interpolating all these old songs into new hits. It's called Samplemousse, which is a play on pamplemousse, obviously. We're just juicing the citrus. But yeah, I mean, we've already had some great success there. We had a big song with Coco Jones, who was nominated for Best New Artist at the Grammys. And right now, one of our songs is sampled in a big hit called Tipsy. The song was called Tipsy, an artist named Shibuzi. It's kind of blowing up right now. And so we're doing a lot in that world and throwing big writing camps where we have all these amazing producers and writers come in to sample and reinterpret our catalog. We've done a strategic partnership with a company that's here and in Mexico and in Miami, really focusing on expanding into Latin America. And we've already had some amazing success on Latin pop radio doing that. We're investing a lot of our time in the gaming and music, the intersection of gaming and music. I really think that gaming itself, I mean, the gaming industry dwarfs the recorded music industry, as you could see everywhere. But I think that music and gaming is becoming such an amazing driver for games and also for gamers, streamers. So we're spending a lot of time interacting on getting music in games, but also delivering our music and partnering with the people who are influencers in the gaming space, who are playing, people watch people play video games. I don't know if you knew that, but it's a big industry. We're doing so many things, and obviously supporting a lot of the legacy artists and people we have out on the road, and Christopher Cross and Run the Jewels, and, you know, celebrating a lot with Charlotte Caffey from the Go-Go's, and just, there's a lot of amazing marketing and celebration initiatives we'll be rolling out all throughout the year. Our podcast that we started, which kind of like gives like the stories behind the songs that we've been starting to do. We did our first one last year around Wrecking Ball, which is one of our songs, and we even had Dolly Parton on it, which was amazing. So, I mean, yeah, honestly, anything fun and creative that we can think about that where we feel like we could share our music with the world, we're jumping on it.
Lillette Pizarro is a founder of Influence Media Partners, a publisher that is building value with music assets, starting with publishing, but also including other revenue streams like name, image, and likeness. Lillette, how did your work with blue chip brands like Pepsi and Apple and pretty big acts like Beyonce and Katy Perry inform your decision and your partners to start Influence?
It's a great question, Larry. Sitting with what I would say are some of the most significant companies or brands and culture that deeply cared about music partnership and basically finding ways to partner with both artists or songwriters or labels themselves to drive new opportunities for the brand or launch a new business proposition was a really interesting time. That space meant working with the CMOs across various companies and helping them set strategy. And it involved negotiating sometimes very complex deals or licenses. So just to give a tangible example, think about PepsiCo's 10-year relationship with the NFL and the halftime show.
Sure.
And how important the halftime show is to music, but also how brilliantly Pepsi has activated music through the halftime show for many years. So it was in that work where I saw a really interesting opportunity, and it really had a bit to do with streaming and on-demand listening.
How
and
so? Social.
Because in that early days of that work, now, not to date myself, but in those early planning days, I remember being in these meetings and, you know, the CMO would say, there's no truly global talent. The data was so limited. We couldn't really say that this artist would be able to, you know, be meaningful in XYZ markets. But streaming and social media really changed that. Like when you started to get really robust, rich data to see that music was truly global, you could see engagement in ways that you weren't able to see it historically. And for partnering in advertising or in marketing historically, one of the challenges was just being able to demonstrate that. Another challenge that, you know, I talk about sometimes very often was when a brand or an advertiser would partner in sports, as an example, and a player gets hurt, the season goes on, right? Mm-hmm. Or if you were to do like a Broadway show, if the lead is out, there is an understudy, right? But it doesn't work the same way in music. And so obviously, if an album gets pushed or a tour gets postponed, it can dramatically impact how a brand would activate and move on. And so now what was starting to happen is there were other ways that we could deeply engage with fans through technology, whether it's a social platform or a streaming platform, and find meaningful and deep connections to music and fandom. And that was a game changer. And it was really in seeing that opportunity that the concept was, and again, Larry, I think you could appreciate like writing a thesis and strategy and being able to execute it are very different. But it was
very true. In fact, we always say we don't get paid for having good ideas. We get paid for executing.
Exactly. Exactly. And again, this is the part of being an entrepreneur. You get this fire in your belly, like when you see this white space, and the fire and like the ambition, the brave ambition was that if we could find a way to really deeply partner with active artists and active songwriters, if we could both help them be co-custodians of their rights and then go back to the advertising and marketing landscape and find new ways to engage and drive new opportunities, that we would be able to unlock opportunity that hasn't been seen before. And then the question was, well, okay, there was this very interesting kind of financial movement into investing in music rights. And it was happening, as you well know, at a rampant race, right? So it became a bit of an arms race with lots of institutional buyers coming in. So for us, it was, we didn't want to compete on price. We wanted to compete on proposition, meaning we want partnership. We want an artist to understand that we're here to be a genuine co-custodian and a songwriter to understand, like, we really want to drive value. And can we find a way to partner? And the idea of partnering around name, image, and likeness and how we would go about and do that also was somewhat of what we tried to approach as a new white space in the way that we architected how to approach that. Because again, these are active artists who have managers and agents and a very active team who are managing these rights. So how could we find a way to find exclusive rights to influence and non-exclusive rights to influence and be part of that team and join their bench and drive new value? And so, again, thesis versus execution, you know, I was bullish. I was nervous, though, to be honest. But I can tell you now, now that we've been able to actually execute quite a few of those as it relates to partnerships, name, image, and likeness partnerships. And now that we're building the muscle and the team who's executing against the name, image, and likeness. And so Visa was a partner with us. They just did a huge concert at the Louvre as a warm-up to the Olympics. And one of our, you know, new signings on the publishing side, her name is Renau. She's a fantastic young Latina artist, opened that show and they licensed her music. And it is this fantastic integration into Roblox. It was a massive win for both us, we believe, and also Visa, who wanted to make a connection to Latin music and an emerging Latin artist. And she's a fantastic bright star. We've got multiple opportunities across various categories that are in the works now, from endorsements to film and television opportunities. So now that the muscle and the execution is happening, oh man, Larry, I just feel like there's just so much more that we're going to be able to unlock, both for music rights and artists and songwriters.
Well, I think that the metrics that we employ when we're looking at buying a recorded music catalog or a catalog of music publishing rights are well understood. So both the metrics and the mechanics of how that works. NIL, name, image, and likeness, not so transparent. What can you tell me about how you think about valuing the NIL rights and how to structure an agreement with an artist and their team that works for everybody?
So, you know, I think some of this obviously comes from my endorsement negotiation days, right? So obviously, as you look at investing in music rights, you spend a lot of time around, as you said, the financial history and also the agreements as it relates to the copyrights. But when it comes to thinking about name, image, and likeness, most talent that, you know, influence will partner with will have either a history and a multi-year history or an ambition, right? So someone like Enrique, obviously, who has a long history of endorsement deals and partnerships. I mean, we obviously spent time understanding that history, what the metrics look like for success, both from a financial perspective, but also for Enrique, like what was really meaningful to him. And then it was important also to understand the go forward and the ambition, things that he hadn't done to date. And we used an insights team, much like you would do in advertising, just to help us define some white spaces and where we should be really be focused on and what that opportunity will look like. And then we added our strategy of, okay, this is where we think influence would be really successful if we focused on these verticals. And in, not just to Enrique, but to all of the way we negotiate our name, image, and likeness deal, because we're working with active artists who tend to have different opportunities, we look for exclusive rights to influence so that, you know, we can take a very focused approach and, you know, drive value both for the artist, the manager, and the agent. So places like sectors, as an example. So if automotive has been a space that someone hasn't been able to unlock, or beauty as a category, or fashion, as so long as it truly aligns to the artist, and we'll make sure that works. In the insights work we do, we try to also understand kind of the marketplace, like how crowded is it? What do we see? What are some of the ventures that have worked or not worked? What are the endorsement deals that are happening in that sector? How crowded is the space? So we'll do work like that. And then essentially in the way that we package these rights, it's in combination with our copyright investment, right? So it's really about, again, coming to partnership versus just a transaction. And I think that's really critical for us. So in being able to do this, it has to be the right artist and the right team. So meaning manager, lawyer, agents that want to partner. Because it can't just be about, I'm just looking for the highest price of my copyrights. If you want to do that work, that's great. That doesn't work for us. We're looking for someone who is really willing to be aligned. And obviously, as you think about acquisition or investment, it has to be fair and it has to be competitive. We want them to want us to make these name, image, and likeness rights more valuable and bring value just as much as we do. So that's critically important to us. And so we need to align as to what we think the goals are, both financial metrics of success for activating those rights and, you know, basically a lane, a path of opportunities. But there is, and I'll say this again, but there is history. So in most cases in which we've done this, I can say we're on deal 5 of name, image, and likeness. There is a financial history of what historic endorsement partnerships, ventures have looked at. So you do have some of that, but it doesn't just inform how we think about the future and how we plan for the future. It's one data point in a more kind of complex process that we do to think about the right way to both invest, partner, and think about name, image, and likeness.
Yeah, so you must be pretty confident in your relationships with production partners and media sponsors and co-venturers in creating new intellectual property that uses name, image, and likeness, rather than, not to minimize the way the rest of this industry works, but just doing the financial engineering around the acquisition of the music copyrights themselves.
You know, honestly, Larry, I thought that opposition was quite boring. The idea of just amassing a library and then buying to potentially sell, it's not that interesting, right? To me, the opportunity to invest, build, and partner was a far more interesting proposition. And being able to work with some of the greatest active artists in music today and help them think through strategies and find new partnerships, that to me is the win-win. And not only for the artists, but for our investors as well, right? You're dealing in a very competitive music rights marketplace. There's a lot of really disciplined investors in the space, and they got those numbers right. We've spent a lot of time in building a really strong investment team. And I would say that our underwriting is both focused and disciplined, and we've done well there. But to us, the real win is both having a partnership with an artist and helping them find new ways to drive new value, both to their legacy rights, but their future of their brand and who they are as an artist and a songwriter.
Let's talk about undervalued genres. Some genres, some corners of the music business have been very overheated in recent years in the copyright acquisition space. Where are the new areas for value creation that maybe are a little bit less crowded? Where do you find value now?
You know, okay, so I'm going to say something probably controversial, and it's not necessarily driven by genre. I think vintages is probably part of the challenge, right? Deep vintage has always commanded a very high value, and for a lot of reasons, right? Quality, predictability. But there is a lot of opportunity in younger vintages that I think the market is finally realizing that. So, and I will define a younger vintage, at least for us, it's sub 30 years of age. I think there is there's a huge opportunity to invest in rights sub 30 years of age. Not to say we wouldn't do deeper vintages, but I do think that younger vintage, or I don't like the term shallow catalog, Larry, that's why I'm trying not to say it, but I do think it gets
You're dancing around it very well.
Yeah, I just think it gets a bad rep. Now, what I will also say, what's interesting is that certain genres, like for instance, I can tell you early on when I wrote this thesis and really wanting to invest deeply in Latin music, when I went to market and I talked to hundreds of investors, a lot thought that was a really bad idea. Not that they had any history of investing in music, they just didn't think that would be a vibrant place to invest and where they would find a great return. And it was interesting to me because as I'm out there and pitching and I'm trying to explain to them, guys, when, you know, Shakira and Jennifer Lopez perform at the halftime show, it's just an indicator of how late we are. Like, Latin music is massive and explosive. Like, there's not only rich financial data, but there's rich engagement data to show how well-placed and vibrant Latin music is. And it was interesting how much pushback we got there. I also had said in some of those early meetings about wanting to invest in music that was coming out of different territories. So specifically, obviously, there was a lot of happening in South Africa and Nigeria. There was stuff happening in the Middle East that we wanted to invest in. And there was a lot of hesitancy around us investing outside of the U.S. core base. So I think that's changed a lot. I mean, look, there's also what some will say is that hip hop doesn't sync as well. And so therefore, hip hop should be considered less valuable. If you're only looking at sync as a factor versus other ways to drive value, like for instance, if this genre has deep engagement with their fans, now you have a plethora of platforms to expose your copyrights and find ways to drive new discovery and engagement. You don't have to only rely on sync. And so again, I think that's where some folks maybe have missed it. But I do think, Larry, and I'm sure you agree, that the market continues to get smarter and smarter And so, you know, some of these, what I would say were anecdotes even just a few years ago, is rapidly changing.
What a difference 5 years makes, right?
Right. Yes. Yes.
If you have a minute for one more question, I should ask you about the AI overhang, the great unknown. How do you think about risk and opportunity in the face of AI as a creation tool, but also as a possible threat for the kinds of music that you invest in?
So it's interesting. We have actually made an investment in a platform that has come up with what we think is both an equitable and legal framework to create derivative works leveraging AI that are both fair to the original copyright holder, but also to the creator. So whether it's a fan or someone else who has decided to use this work. So we're very excited about the learnings from this investment. I can tell you this, Larry, that one of the founders of this AI is an artist. And this artist has used this as a case study to engage their fans. And it was really successful, both from the sense of that the fans were happy to pay a fair license to use the copyright and then create a derivative work that they will share with the original rights holders. And this is now just a small investment that we've made, but I find like the market is keenly sensitive to finding both a framework that is fair and legal so that we can leverage AI to benefit rights holders. And so I know that there is obviously a lot of concern around unsanctioned AI, as there should be. And there is a lot of focus on making sure that protections are in place and as it should be. But I am a bit optimistic about getting to a place where we're going to be able to leverage AI, not only to engage fans, but to improve collections, to really help modernize some of kind of the spaces that it's a coming of time to do. So I'm probably a little bit more optimistic on the topic than others.
Music publishing is complicated and becoming better understood. It's entering a new phase, and it's exciting to chat with some of the people who are driving and documenting that change. This Musonomics podcast was executive produced by Lars Murray. If you like what you heard, share the episode with a friend and be sure to follow us wherever you get your pods so you don't ever miss a new episode. And while you're at it, please give us a rating or review on Spotify or Apple Pods. It really helps new listeners find our show. From the Music Business Program at NYU Steinhardt, I'm Larry Miller. Thanks for listening.